Welcome to the UK's only weekly FM and DAB radio show about transport. I'm Mark Ovenden and this is The Catchcast. This week, direct from Montreal, one of our most celebrated award-winning transport authors of our time. He's also a journalist, a lecturer and now a professor of creative writing, no less. Welcome to The Catchcast, Taras Gresko.
Hey, a real pleasure to be with you.
We are going to delve deeply into your fascinating career, but may I please ask first the same question I asked to all of my guests, actually. When and how did you get into the subject of trains and transport, Taras?
Oh, that goes way back. I'm one of those rare North Americans who doesn't own a car. So I began my travel writing career about 30 years ago, and I was very meticulous about riding public transportation and trains wherever I could. The passion might go back to model railroads when I was a kid, or perhaps it was a cross-country trip I took on the Canadian from Toronto to Vancouver. In retrospect, it might have been the Supercontinental, but I have strong memories of just falling in love with the romance of train travel in Canada, where the distances are great, when I was probably about 7 years old.
Good time to start, I say. Good time to get all the kids involved in loving transport when they're young. And I believe you had a little project, something to do with converting streets to parks when you were a kid.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, I guess I was an urbanist with a Prince Valiant haircut. I remember we moved from Toronto, the suburbs of Toronto, to Vancouver, and I wanted to be able to play in front of my street, but there were a lot of cars going up and down the street. So I came up with a proposal and made a model using Monopoly hotels and houses to ban cars from in front of our street and turn it into a park, and the cars would then use the alley behind our house. I even went on to a local cable television station to promote my idea. So I guess this career in transportation urbanism has been brewing for a long time.
Oh, crikey, you really were setting the flag in the sand there, weren't you? I think you went to university in Vancouver, wasn't it? What did you study there, Taras?
You know what? I studied English literature. Mm-hmm. I took a degree, a bachelor's degree in English literature. And my interest in cities came from in my mid-20s after university. I started sort of poking around Europe and Asia and walking and taking public transportation around cities. And that's a great crash course in urban form and urbanism, the morphology of cities, how they work. And I always noticed that I gravitated towards cities where cars didn't dominate, where the bones of the city were laid down by pedestrians, by horses, by horse cars, by trolleys, later by other forms of public transportation like commuter rail. That's what really intrigued me. The thesis I'm developing is that, you know, the landscapes created by trains and public transportation, pedestrian areas, are better than the landscapes created by automobiles. And that's very flagrant in North America. I really see it. We still have the legacy of very interesting areas in North American cities created by streetcars, the famous streetcar suburbs, which are the most desirable and walkable parts of the cities. And there are still these sort of metropolitan corridors that were created in the early 20th century by the railway networks. Mm-hmm. You're surrounded by it in England and Europe, but it's a little harder to find in North America, where so much of our metropolitan form has been determined by the big bang of the automobile.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we'll come on to discuss exactly how that has affected life for people. And I believe one of those cities that you walked around and took transit in was Paris.
I lived there. I lived in Paris for 4 years after university. Came to love it. I now live in Montreal for one reason or another. I've spent half my life in French-speaking cities. Yeah, Paris, I was very poor. I could barely afford metro tickets at the time. I was just an English teacher there. And so I spent a lot of time walking around the city and getting to know it. That's the city for me, UR city. You know, it goes back to Roman times, to Lutèce, to the original Roman city. And you can see, it's like a palimpsest. You can see the original city going, you know, if you start from kilometer zero. So I spent a hell of a lot of time walking around the city and seeing how it was formed at various times by the kinds of transportation that dominated in each phase of its growth.
even the way that the walls of Paris moved out from time to time, and eventually the last one was turned into the Boulevard Périphérique. And I think you moved back to Canada in 1994. Is that when you went to Montreal and then you started being involved in journalism and stuff, yeah?
I started doing some travel writing when I was in Paris, but yes, mm-hmm. our relationship broke up and I moved to Montreal, a city where I'd briefly gone to university, to McGill University, and I'd loved it on the first couple of times I'd visited it. I still love it. I've spent 30 years here. Don't like the winters. we are one of the snowiest major city in the world, neck and neck with Sapporo, Japan, which is a real challenge. I mean, I grew up in Vancouver, which the climate there is a lot more like what you get in most of England. So I think it is one of North America's great cities, except the climate has some serious downsides.
And I think you wrote your first big book, as it were, Sacre Blues. It's really based on your move to Quebec, isn't it?
Yeah. It was kind of it was written right after a very important political event, a referendum here in Canada, which saw voters in Quebec coming very close to voting to secede from Canada. And I wrote that book during the aftermath of that. The country was kind of in shock. It was a near death experience for the Canadian Confederation. And it was an interesting time to be in Montreal. Things were very cheap. A lot of people left at the time. The city seemed kind of deserted. It was very bohemian, a great time for the arts, mostly because the rents were so cheap. I really enjoyed it. I still love being here and I love the French culture here.
Your first book then has been very, very highly acclaimed, but it's not perhaps always the best advert for the province, was it? Were there any other sort of hiccups and surprises that you first noticed, even being a fluent French speaker maybe?
Oh, no. It took a little while for me to tease out what the difference between les Français de France et les Québécois was. You know, I mean, I'd learned Parisian French, and the kind of French that was spoken here goes back almost to the 16th century with a lot of Anglicisms. So I was perceived kind of as a snob because of my sort of Parisian accent when I got here. That was a challenge. It's a very, you know, it's a very down-to-earth kind of culture, love of, I don't know, poutine and bagels from the Jewish influence. Hockey is really big here. It's very endearing. Quebec really gets under my skin. And now when I go back to Paris, I find them kind of unbearably pretentious. It's funny how your perspective changes.
Now, I know you love high-speed trains, and we're going to speak a bit about your high-speed blog in a bit. And you've made many voyages, which I hope you'll entertain us with also in a little while. But tell me something about how you came to leave your newborn baby on a platform in Italy.
No, that was just a photo op, Mark. We didn't abandon the baby on the platform. Our son, Desmond, was 4 months old and our first child, so we decided to take a trip to Italy, but we were committed to doing it without a car. So we did carry a kind of a car seat around with us, and I posed the car seat on a platform in Florence in front of what I think it was a high-speed train, maybe a Frecciarossa. And I took a little picture of him there. But we did the whole trip. Maybe we got into one or two taxis. My favorite moments were passing Desmond in this little car seat that could also be snapped into a stroller, into a Vaporetto, and having the people in Venice and having the people in there helping us lift him up over the canal into the Vaporetto.
Don't drop Desmond in the canal, for goodness sake. Before we get into your transport blogs and books, you must tell me more about some of your other books. There was one called The End of Elsewhere and the very interestingly named Bottom Feeder.
Yeah. The End of Elsewhere was an examination of the impact of mass tourism on the world. I didn't do a gap year after university. I basically went to Paris, but I never did that kind of year where you backpack around Europe or Asia. So I think I was 30 years old, I decided to travel from one end of Europe, from Finisterre in Spain, to a place called Tianya Haijiao in China, using a variety of means, from hitchhiking to walking the Camino de Santiago, but in the opposite direction, always moving from west to east. And every chapter looked at a different aspect of the development of mass tourism and the impact it has in the world. That was my second book. A Bottom Feeder was interesting. An unfortunate title. It did not work very well in the UK. It was changed. It was changed to The Dead Seas. As a matter of fact, every time I tried to submit the manuscript, it was picked off. Bottom Feeder, of course, refers to fish at the bottom of the food chain. Sometimes used to refer to lawyers. And it was a book about the impact of human appetite on the oceans. It was kind of a global expose on overfishing and the impacts of aquaculture. So I have a variety of interests, but I find that I'm always coming back to transportation. It's a recurring theme in my writing. I think I might be best known to a lot of people for a book I wrote called Strap Hanger.
Yeah, that was kind of my first introduction to your writing work with Strap Hanger.
We met in Paris because I was researching the chapter on Paris, and you and Julian Pinster of the RATP kindly gave me a tour of some of the ghost stations of the Paris Metro, which made that chapter very lively.
Oh, and what fun we didn't get up to in those things, looking at all the beautiful old porcelain adverts on the side of the walls and stuff. But what came first, though? Was it the blog or the book of that name? How did they kind of evolve together, your Strap Hanger work?
The blog is recent. Strap Hanger was my fifth book. Yeah, it just came from my enduring, going back to when I was an 8-year-old urbanist. I've been observing cities and trying to figure out how they worked and how they can work better. So in that book, I went to 14 cities around the world, from Bogota in Colombia to Tokyo and Shanghai, by way of a lot of European cities, and some in Canada and the United States, including Vancouver and Philadelphia and Toronto and Los Angeles. Some places do transportation very well, some do it very poorly. After Strap Hanger, I kind of went on the lecture circuit, you know, giving talks about transportation and alternatives to sort of car-based living. And since then, my focus has really been on trains, and I'm kind of torn. I put together a proposal for a book about high-speed trains, and I would like to write that. But right now, I'm working on a project in which I'm going to ride every passenger train in Canada, from one that goes into the Yukon, from Skagway, Alaska, to Canada's Yukon, to the Ocean, which is the oldest continuously running named train in the world, which goes from Halifax to Montreal, where I live. So yeah, I've already started the process. It's a lot of fun. I'm really torn between my belief that high-speed trains are a fantastic idea. They're a way of getting people out of polluting short-haul airplanes, for example. And we need a lot more of them in North America, and we're having trouble building them. And the fact that I do love a good slow train. I love a real train journey, and I love the adventures that are involved in that. So this book is going to be mostly about sort of adventures on trains. I recently got back from taking the Canadian, a 4-day trip from Vancouver to Toronto. The train still uses stainless steel passenger cars that were built in 1954 and 1955 by the Budd Company in Philadelphia. I think it's the oldest continuously running rolling stock for any passenger fleet in the world. And they're in remarkably good shape, including the observation cars, the very, very comfortable passenger cars. There's kind of an elite section of the back called the prestige section, where people pay thousands of dollars, where the cars have been refurbished. But they're still the original park cars, they're called, named after Canada's national parks. It's a wonderful ride.
Wow. That sounds incredible. I would love to get the chance to do that at some point. I wonder if you can help us to understand, though, and you cover a lot of this in Strap Hanger, and I'm sure it's going to be featured in your new book as well, how kind of utterly car-fixated North America is. I mean, I remember a classic photograph, for example. It was a photograph of a car park for a gym with an escalator going up one floor. And that seems to sort of sum it up to me. But can you kind of explain how fixated Americans become with the car?
Yeah, I mean, how do we put this in perspective? It's just awful, of course. I think there was this sort of big bang that happened after the Second World War, where urbanism, where city planning just became completely centered around the idea that people would own one or two cars. And I think particularly in the western parts of North America and the southern parts of the United States, car culture is just ubiquitous. People will get into their car and drive to a neighbor's house, which might be 5 or 6 doors along, and then park the car there because often there's no sidewalks in the subdivision. So it all makes sense. The life is built around the automobile. That said, I live in Montreal, a city where, like some other cities, about 50% of households don't own cars.
Wow.
New York, very similar. Places like Philadelphia and Boston, San Francisco, Seattle, Portland, you can comfortably get by without cars. One of the weaknesses in that, though, is the intercity side of things. And I'm talking about trains, of course. So as I'm doing the historical research for this book, I'm discovering that Canada was one of the world's great railway nations. Up until the silver age of trains, up until the mid-1950s, when jetliners started to come in. And they called the Canadian National, which is arguably the world's most successful publicly run company, they called it the greatest travel system in the world. And it competed with a private company, Canadian Pacific. So the standards were very high. And looking at old railway maps and timetables, you could get all over this continent by trains up until the mid-1950s. So it's interesting. We have the bones still exist, the corridors still exist, and I think that they can be reinvigorated. You have the density of population in Britain. You've never completely, I mean, there was the beaching acts in the 60s. You got rid of a lot of routes, but it's still a strong railway culture. And I think there's a hunger for that here in North America.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, America has some of the world's earliest subways and fantastic streetcar systems. Such a shame that they got overridden by the car. Now, following the huge success of Strap Hanger, the book and the blog, you've set up a new online feed called High Speed.
Yeah, so I do a thing called High Speed, one word, highspeed.blog, where I'm chronicling the passenger rail revival in North America. Amtrak in the United States is setting record numbers for ridership, and they're adding new routes. And as soon as they add new routes, like the Hiawatha or reviving the Mardi Gras, which goes from Mobile to New Orleans, I think, they're getting a huge, huge uptake from riders. And now in Canada, we've been discussing it for 40 years, but now we seem to be moving ahead with a high-speed rail project between our two largest cities, Toronto and Montreal, and they'd also connect Ottawa and Quebec City. This is a part of Canada where 50% of the population lives. It's a small corridor. Canada's population, in spite of this being a huge country, is very highly concentrated. So there's interesting things happening. There's a real demand for passenger rail outside of these major corridors and leisure travel, but there's also a recognition that, you know, highways and runways, airports, aren't doing the job anymore.
And I believe I'm right in saying that one of your recent posts was called "We Need Railways, Not Runways," which just seems so obvious, right? Oh, come on.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we've had that discussion for a long time in the UK. You're struggling to get HS2 built, and there's the additional runways at Heathrow. We're having that discussion in Toronto, Canada's largest city, because they are thinking of expanding an airport on an island near the center of Toronto. There are only propeller planes going there right now, and they're thinking of extending the runway and adding jets. And it's a bad idea. I argue that we should be not focusing on adding lanes to highways, adding length to runways at airports, but investing our billions where it's most needed in clean, sustainable, electric, high-speed rail powered by Canada's abundant hydroelectricity. So it seems like at a time when people are talking about American tariffs and Trump's threatening to make Canada the 51st state, this is being perceived in our country as kind of a nation-building project using Canadian aluminum, Canadian steel, Canadian wood to boost our expertise in an area where we were once renowned, railway building. So in my highspeed.blog, I kind of chronicle the passenger railway revival that's going on in North America. And I make the case for both slow trains, the beautiful excursion trains that we have here, and which provide essential services to people who live in remote northern and rural areas, and also this project, which I think is crucial for Canada's future.
So on highspeed.blog, how do you kind of summarize the state of high-speed rail construction, not just around the world, but how that particularly affects North America, Canada, and the US, and also the UK too? Are we doing a good job in building new high-speed compared to other countries?
Well, you're struggling to build HS2. Mm. You've been doing it for a long time. I mean, going back to the 19th century, the UK was the originator of passenger rail and became the world's great railway builder. But you've kind of been left behind, and the Europeans have taken your crown. And now China, which has built the world's largest high-speed rail network, I think it's coming up on 50,000 kilometers by 2030. It's definitely taking your crown. I'm about to go to Morocco to ride the El Borac. Morocco has high-speed rail. Canada is the only G7 country that has not a single kilometer of high-speed rail. We share most of our lines with freight trains right now, our passenger lines, which makes them very, very unpredictable. I love riding the trains in the UK, but I know it's going through big reorganization. The last time I was in Britain, I had some very bad experiences on busy, overcrowded trains, and I found them quite expensive. Mm. So I'm a believer in the idea that publicly run companies can do a great job. Canadian National was one, and I think British Rail did a fantastic job in the 1980s, before that first wave of privatization. I'm curious to see what's going to happen in the UK with the move away from privatization towards sort of public running of the trains.
Well, we're all hoping it comes out a little bit better news than the last 20 or 30 years. And what about the situation with the high-speed line in California? I mean, you keep seeing things online that there are farmers saying don't build it through our farm, and there's lots of anti voices. Do you think it's going to happen? Will it get built?
Well, listen, you probably remember when they were trying to build HS1 through Kent, there was a lot of protests from locals who wanted to keep the green and pleasant land from being marred by, and the same thing happened with HS2. Mm. The same thing happened with the TGV in France. It was winemakers in that case and farmers who were saying, you are going to destroy the timelessness of the French countryside. It got built and it's now beloved by the French. What people don't seem to talk about is the fact that rail corridors are quite narrow compared to highways. Mm. 60 meters, they tend to blend in relatively well with the landscape. And they're nowhere near as intrusive as the competing modes, airplanes and airports that take up a vast amount of land, and motorways. So yeah, in California, they're facing the usual problem. Although Trump, of course, was not a fan of this. All kinds of billions in federal money were pulled. The conservative media often spotlights the protests of trackside landowners. We're experiencing the same thing here. They are in California, in Canada, where beekeepers and, frankly, relatively wealthy farmers are making the case that this will destroy their livelihood and cut the countryside in two. It's not the case. Mm. I mean, there are overpasses and underpasses and viaducts and all kinds of things that unintelligently planned fast railway system can provide to prevent that from happening. Yeah, we've got a world full of experience right now. It's just the headwinds that every major project face, but I think in California, because of the cultural context and the fact that the federal government is no longer helping at all, and in fact is kind of doing the opposite, hoping that the project fails. I mean, I wish them well, but I'll be surprised if they connect San Francisco and Los Angeles in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm. What a shame, because what a great journey that would be. But on the brighter side, not just in North America, but around the world, we've got new transit systems opening, the new REM stations in Montreal, Seattle's new light rail floating bridge, the Paris Grand Express, all the stuff in Asia. I mean, there are some great transport projects happening, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. I think on a global basis, it's a new golden age for rail. I mean, if you look at what China alone has done, I mean, and Spain, fantastic progress. And Spain is wonderful because so much of the electric power for the high-speed rail there comes from wind and solar. Mm. I mean, that's the future. I mean, that's what I'm going to see in Morocco, I think, later this month when I go visit. A lot of the power for their El Borac train is generated by wind and solar. I believe Egypt is building a new high-speed train line. Yeah, it just seems so obvious to me because the mega cities that so much of the world lives in, they just can't sustain automobiles as a form of public transportation. There's just not enough room. And yeah, too many cities have succumbed, like Jakarta and Lagos have succumbed to gridlock when they try to make it a de facto automobiles, the de facto public transportation system. So yeah, the future is grand for the rubber of, you know, well-run bus systems, but also the steel of well-run rail systems.
It's good to finish on a positive note, Taras, but we have to stop there. Thank you so much for joining us from Montreal.
A real pleasure. I could talk about this for hours, so I'm glad you've cut me off.
Well, me too. If you want to carry on hearing about Taras's work, you can look up his books online from your favourite portal. Just search for Taras Gresko. He posts frequently to highspeed.blog. That's H-I-G-H speed.blog. You can also find his strap hanger posts there too. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. Please do join us then.